Capitol Hill has long been considered the center of Seattle gay culture, but the beacon of Capitol Hill is fading as straight people take over. According to the U.S. Census, 5% of households in Capitol Hill's Broadway district were same-sex couples back in 2000. Today, the percentage of same-sex households has dropped by more than half. Pony is a gay bar on Capitol Hill. It's one of the last holdouts of the gayness of yesteryear. It's raunchy, it's bawdy. It wants straight newcomers to know that it intends to stay that way.
Attention, this is a gay bar, a very gay bar. If you aren't queer or a respectful ally, get lost. P.S. This isn't a zoo and we're not your pets.
That's on a bright pink sign that hangs at the front door of Pony, read there by manager Marcus Wilson. He says changing demographics on Capitol Hill have been tough on his business.
Capitol Hill has kind of become what Pioneer Square was a few years ago, and Belltown as well. And it's just become so overwhelmingly popular with like young, straight, 20-somethings that are just kind of like permanently on spring break. And they just kind of have this like attack, dominate mentality. And they don't even necessarily know what this place is. It's just yet another stop on this like drunken bar crawl. The bar was filling up so quickly with straight people that were, I think, largely ignorant to where they even were. And it seemed like you were at an aggressively straight nightclub in Pioneer Square or Belltown. And so it was driving away the people that this bar is really intended for. And so that's why I made that sign.
Marcus Wilson from the gay bar Pony, where he's the manager. The influx of young straights isn't the only reason that gay people are leaving Capitol Hill. Between 2000 and 2012, the percentage of gay households increased in every neighborhood in Seattle except Capitol Hill. Amin Gaziani is an associate professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia, and he's analyzed the changing role of gay neighborhoods in his new book. It's called There Goes the Gayborhood. He says gayborhoods began as refuges for LGBT people from heterosexual culture.
Gayborhoods in the United States first formed following World War II, when gay men and lesbians who were discharged from the military as a result of their real or perceived homosexuality decided to remain behind in major urban centers rather than returning home disgraced. These areas flourished some decades later following the Stonewall riots of 1969, so we're talking about the 70s and 80s. At that time, many gay men and lesbians perceived these urban districts as a beacon of tolerance in a sea of heterosexual hostility. This marked a moment in time that demographers refer to as the Great Gay Migration.
Why do gay people leave gayborhoods? We're seeing that on Seattle's Capitol Hill.
There are a number of reasons why we're witnessing these trends. Some gays are priced out. Others, I think, are evolving out, if you will. So it is certainly true that areas that have a large concentration of gay and lesbian households have seen greater increases in housing prices than the national average. Specifically, if an area has male same-sex households in proportions of more than 1%, let's say, that area will experience roughly a 14% price increase. An area that has female same-sex households greater than 1% will experience 16.5% price increase. The national average, on the other hand, is somewhere between 10 and 11%. We also know that same-sex couples earn, on average, $15,000 annually less than opposite-sex households, despite the culturally prevalent stereotype that gay men and lesbians earn more. That is untrue. When you combine those two factors, you have an economic effect. We generally think in terms of economics, but I think a comparatively underemphasized part of the story is also pertains to the unprecedented acceptance of gays and lesbians into the mainstream of American society. Increasingly, gay men and lesbians perceive the entire city as the functional equivalent of the gayhood. There was a story on the Seattle Times about the demographic changes in Capitol Hill, and one individual commented at the end of the story by saying Seattle is being in all caps, a gayborhood. There are versions of this that we hear across the country. I heard San Francisco is the Castro. The entire island of Manhattan is gay, or the entire north side of Chicago is gay. Where once gay men and lesbians perceived the singular streets of gayborhoods as a safe space, they now, as a result of acceptance, perceive the entire place as reasonably comfortable and safe for them to live. The second reason is what I call a sense of cultural sameness. Neither gays nor straights perceive one another as all that different from each other. They're not all that interested in sexual orientation to begin with. In other words, people's sexual orientation no longer forms a central defining aspect of their self-identity.
Well, how has the acceptance of gay people by society affected gay culture the way it might have existed 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
There are some concerns that acceptance comes with a cultural cost, and that cost is the declining salience of gay culture or the declining distinctiveness of gay culture. If people no longer care very much whether you self-identify as gay or straight, then a logical extension that emerges from that is a question, well, if gays and straights are not differentiable, then is gay culture distinct?
If gays are priced out of neighborhoods, are they moving to other neighborhoods and in turn pricing out people there?
Sociologists have in fact shown that gay men, along with other groups such as artists, lesbians, students, are often involved in early stages of urban revitalization or renewal. Lesbians typically pave the way. There's a sociologist in New York. Her name is Sharon Zukin. She characterizes lesbians as, quote, canaries in the urban coal mine, unquote. This makes sense for economic reasons because they still earn less than men on average for doing the same job. And so, and in wanting to be with one another, they will typically move into areas that are progressive but also affordable. When gay men, who tend to be in a different area of the city, find themselves either priced out or no longer enjoying the gay neighborhood because it's sexually integrating, let's say, for example, as they decide where to move next, many of them follow where the lesbians are. As they move into that area, and they use their incomes to fix up the area, then prices increase. So there is a multiple or a multi-layered process of increasing prices based on where these individuals move.
I'm talking to Amin Ghaziani, associate professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia. He specializes in sexuality in social movements. You know, in some neighborhoods in Seattle, like the Central District, became less black and many white couples began to move in and gentrification took place. There was a mixed reaction, I would say, by people in those neighborhoods to the new arrivals. How are gay people reacting to people moving into their gayborhoods?
There is similarly a mixed reaction. On the one hand, trends towards sexual integration provide for many people evidence for increasing equality. Maybe we all can get along after all, to put it colloquially, or at least in terms of the decisions we make about where to live. On the other hand, there are individuals who are, I believe, rightfully concerned about some opposing notions. For instance, the United States has what we call a pluralist political system. This requires the recognition of grouphood, and it's precisely why we have important ideas like voting blocks. The loss of clusters, therefore, may have implications for the LGBT community in terms of exercising political or electoral influence. Now, you might also say that we are moving toward a situation of full legislative equality for sexual minorities. It's only a matter of moments before same-sex marriage becomes the law of the land. And to that, I might respond by saying that equality in the books of law is certainly not the same thing as how we think about the meaning or morality of sexuality. Note, for instance, a recent study came out that indicated that hate crimes against non-heterosexuals continues at alarming levels, and especially against transgender people. We know that housing discrimination against same-sex households persists, but those levels of housing discrimination tend to be lower in gay neighborhoods. We still need gay neighborhoods as safe spaces, places that protect LGBT people from bigotry and bias. Here's one way you might think about it. Has racism gone away? Or has sexism gone away? Homophobia is still tenacious as well.
Well, Seattle as a whole had the third highest rate of hate crimes against LGBT people among large U.S. cities in 2012. That's according to FBI data. If the entire city is a gayborhood, what does that say about these hate crimes? And when neighborhoods and cities indeed become gayborhoods.
You know, that's fascinating. I think the fact that you raise that to me suggests that despite perceptions of an expanding residential imagination, despite feelings of increased safety and comfort in greater parts of the city than in others, those statistics underscore the importance of gay neighborhoods as places where LGBT people presumably are at least a bit safer than they are in other parts of the city. This is not to say that they ought to be or feel the need to be confined to just those areas, but they do nonetheless provide a buffer against these types of situations.
Amin, it's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for having me, Ross.
Amin Ghaziani, an associate professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia, he takes a look at the changing role of gay neighborhoods in his new book called There Goes the Gayborhood.